our instinct, our gut brain is saying, this is not okay, you know? Mm-hmm. But our more intellectual side says, well, everyone's living like this, and I guess you got to keep up, and I guess, you know, this is what the way it is now. And yet our instinct says, not so fast.
Welcome to the Minimal Mom Podcast. Join us each week as we dive into practical tips, real-life stories, and expert interviews to guide you through the art of decluttering, intentional living, and finding joy in the simple moments.
Today, I'm joined by Kim John Payne, author of Simplicity Parenting. And when anyone asks, what book do you recommend for simple living and families and parenting? It is hands down Simplicity Parenting. Kim talks about not only how can we create a space and simplify our home in a way that kids will thrive, but he uses his extensive experience with thousands of families to talk about how we can simplify our schedules, deal with picky eaters, and overall raise kids that are happy and content. This is one of my favorite interviews yet, and I really hope you enjoy it.
I think you describe it well when you say we're running at a feverish pace right now, and we just can't keep that going. And so, Kim, first thing this morning, if you could say one thing to parents, maybe they're only going to catch the first few minutes of this, they'll get distracted by the end. If you could say one thing to parents this morning, what would you say?
that's so funny that we're talking about simplicity and slowing things down, and yeah.
All right. Really.
I'd say just make a cup of tea and sit on down for a moment, really. That I think that's what I'd say. If there was one thing, it wouldn't be do something that some author has written about. It would be trust your instinct.
Yeah.
And let your instinct, your gut brain, really have its voice.
Do you think, I'm kind of wondering as you're saying this, as parents, I don't know if we trust our instincts anymore. And if we've been keeping this same pace our kids have, and we have so many inputs now, and we don't have a lot of time to sit and have a cup of tea and just really sense what our instincts are, do you sense that with parents now, that we don't trust our instincts and we're always looking to outside sources and what other parents are doing to inform our decisions as parents?
I'm actually really hopeful that parents are understanding that this pace of life, and it's not even just the pacing, it's the disconnect that the pacing brings. Mm-hmm. I've been seriously encouraged by just how many parents are now coming around to that. It's almost like we've reached peak stress.
Okay.
Like there's peak oil, you're right. Yeah. You know? But there's also peak family stress. And a lot of parents have just got to that point of saying, unless something changes, we're not gonna cope. And also, our kids just aren't at their best. My little girl, my boy, my child is better than this. Mm-hmm. You know, like, why does everything have to be so hard? It doesn't have to be this way.
Yeah.
And I'm not disillusioned in that sense, but we've sure got some work to do.
Yeah. So would you be able to describe for those maybe who haven't started the book yet or just becoming familiar with it, could you describe your experience in working in refugee camps and then what you saw when you went back home to a first world country or to more civilization, what you were seeing in kids?
Yeah, it began even one step back, Dawn, just to nutshell this. When I was working in a group home for very, very troubled youth, and I was doing that in the nighttime from 6 o'clock in the night to 2 o'clock in the morning. It was called the action shift because, well, it was. It actually was. And I was just a young guy, and I was studying psychology, and I always add, and I'm okay now. I'm okay now. I'm fine. It's a long way back. And I was taking a course with a fascinating, a really wonderful, heart-centered, fascinating doctor who had been a medic in the Second World War and then had graduated and certified and was a doctor in the Korean War. And he'd gone further and was now a psychiatrist. And he was talking about what we now know as PTSD. He called it trauma response back then. And he was describing combat veterans who we used to call, do you remember that term, shell-shocked?
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. And he was describing veterans. And as he was describing them, he was actually not only describing veterans, he was giving a very accurate picture of the kids in my group home who I just really cared for deeply, but had very, very troubled lives. And he was sort of discussing and describing nervous combat veterans. And I thought, check, anxious, yep, fearful, yep. Over-controlling, when he talked about that in one class, I thought, oh my goodness, that's exactly what's going on. Over-controlling, rejecting anything new, only wanting, you know, like no change. Change would really set these kids off. And what he described as an emotional hair trigger. And I'm thinking, yep, that's Maria, that's Warren. Yeah. That's James. That's Mitch. So I invited him to come to the group home. The kids called him Dr. Dude, and they loved him dearly. He was such a sweet man. And he said, these kids are just like combat veterans.
Yeah.
And so he gave me a lot of hints as to how to work with them. I was just a young guy in my early 20s, but he gave me a lot of hints as to how to work with him. It was very kind of him to spend time with me. After that, I graduated and off I went. That's the part, Dawn, when I was working in the refugee camps. Mm-hmm. I was traveling and volunteering, first of all, in Jakarta, in the kampongs of Jakarta, some of the most impoverished areas imaginable. And then up to at the end of the Vietnam War in the Thai Cambodian refugee camps. And there again, I saw nervous, jumpy, hypervigilant, over-controlling, all the stuff that Dr. Taylor had spoken about back at college. There it was again. But, like most of us could get our mind around that because these kids were coming from war and, very dislocated families. A lot of them have their mummies or daddies with them. And, I could understand that one. But it was still very disturbing. A lot of night terrors, a lot of issues about sleep, a lot of issues around sleep. It's when I first got onto this. Sleep was a problem. Eating was a problem. And toilet training, pottying for the little ones was a real problem.
Okay.
And I kind of started to get my mind around that because when life is out of control and you're just a really little kid, the three things you can control are you can't make me sleep, you can't make me eat, and you can't make me poop. Wow. And so they would control those three things very, very strongly. And they would control their play. There were a lot of issues around their ability to play. They couldn't play Nelly so easily. They wouldn't join in, or if they would join in, they would try to over-control. And a lot of fights and arguments, not just for little ones, but older, teenagers and teenagers. A lot of issues because they were trying to control their world in an out-of-control environment, right? So when my time was up there, I decided to study this a little bit more. But at the time, there just really were not courses in what we would, there are lots of them now, thank goodness. But back then, courses in trauma studies and anything like that, not so much. But I sort of put together my own post-grad kind of thing. But I set up a little counseling practice. And I think this is where your question was heading, Dawn.
Yeah.
So this is a long answer, but it was a really good question. So it's your fault. it's an interesting point, I hope, that I set up this little counseling practice west of London in the UK, and through the door came kids that just looked like they'd come out of a war zone. You know, they were nervous and jumpy and hypervigilant and over-controlling, all that emotional hair trigger stuff, all those things that I'd seen in the group home. And you could kind of understand that.
Yeah.
War zones, kind of understand that. But hang on, how do you understand these kids coming from mixed economic backgrounds, mixed ethnic, racial backgrounds, just like what's going on here? And it was a really disturbing thought. That's when I had to dig in a little bit and try and understand this. Because it looked like the undeclared war on childhood. It really looked like that a lot. Maybe not quite as severe, but gosh, it was going in that direction.
Yeah. And I'm just even seeing some comments now of, wow, yes, resonating with this, the competitive soccer practices 3 days a week, games on the weekends, if we could start over and move to another place. And so I think what you're saying too is, as it's mostly moms tuning in here, we have this instinct that this pace is not sustainable for our kids, but this fear comes in now of either we're going to look weird. I had that fear when we highly simplified our kids' toys in our house, that people were going to walk in and think I was a bad mom because I didn't have all the things for my kids, or because, and we run into this too, we're not putting our kids in all of the activities. So surely we are depriving them. So as parents, how do we resist the pressures of the world around us to do parenting how the world is saying that we should be doing it right now?
Yeah, two quick points on. One is, back then, what the time I was talking about, this is the early to mid 80s, there was just starting to be brain imaging available. It was on microfish. Do you remember micro?
Yeah, anyway,
yeah, I know, right? And but there were studies being released, and it was being found that there was a trauma brain. There was a brain that hung on to being, and essentially, it's what I came to think of as overwhelm, the overwhelm state. Because the one thing these kids all had in common, and I started visiting them at home, and because I couldn't figure it out, and it was a little bit scary, like, hey, hang on a minute. These kids should not look like refugees. I know refugees.
Yeah.
I'd spent a lot of time in it, and these kids should not look like this. But what I did find as a common thread, it took several months before I could really be somewhat sure, was that things were moving too fast. It was too sexy, too young, too much, too early, and they were in a state of overwhelm, but it was cumulative. It was slightly under the radar, and it had become normalized. Now, this is back in the mid 80s, for goodness sake, you know, but it had become normalized, this pace of life. So therefore, you know, I didn't have too many advanced degrees at that stage, so I could do stuff that was just simple.
You didn't get all the funding and everything back then, and the attention.
Right. Just go ahead and just do it. I thought, well, if stress can be cumulative, what about cumulatively we take it away? Like that's pretty not academically complicated. And what about we just simplify? What about we unstress? What about we dial back in any way we can? What can we do? So we'd sit and we'd figure it out. There was no answer, no one thing, not back then. There were, like, I've come to see patterns now after 30 years. I've definitely come to see patterns of things that are very successful, really highly successful, but not back then. And so what we started seeing, Dawn, is this thing I write about in the Simplicity Parenting book, that all kids are quirky. They've all got their own little quirks that makes them so lovable and kind of infuriating, something, you know, but they got their beautiful little quirks. When you add cumulative stress to that, this sort of base beat of just overwhelm of too much, what happens is that quirk starts to become inflamed and it starts to become problematic. Like the very busy child who's just very busy starts to become very agitated. But if the stress goes on month after month, the overwhelm goes on, the normal, the new ubiquitous overwhelm goes on, then that child's not just busy, not just agitated, now they're hyperactive.
Yeah.
Right? If a child is just a very sensitive one, you know, really aware of other people, the problematic behavior is they become a little bit anxious, and if that goes on, you can have a lot of anxiety related disorders. So on and so on it goes. All these little quirks can become disorders. But what we saw pretty quickly within a few months is that as we simplified and moved it back along a spectrum back into being just quirky, mums and dads would say, I feel like I've got my little boy back.
Yeah.
You know, like, can we keep doing this? And I say, well, yeah.
Please, right?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go. And what I came to realize in a nutshell is that the first overwhelm was a kind of a quirk fever, like a temperament or character fever.
Okay.
Whatever their temperament was became fevered and problematic.
Yeah.
As we would simplify and do whatever we could, and we can go through some of those steps maybe, what would happen is that they wouldn't just stop at being quirky. That was their gift.
Yeah.
So the busy child or the feisty child, and their disorder was ODD, opposition defiance disorder. Yes.
Yeah.
Or a lot of, just even when it's not a full-blown disorder, but it's a lot of pushback.
Mm-hmm.
Their quirk is they're just feisty.
Yeah.
Right? Now, they're pushing back really hard because their brain, their amygdala, the fight, flight, freeze, or flock brain, saying, your life depends on not putting on this coat.
Mm.
Your life depends on it. And you think, as a mom, you think, oh, my goodness, it's like he's wreathing on the ground because I just want to put his coat on.
Yeah.
He's running away. He's screaming. And all we're trying to do is get in the bath.
Right.
But the gift of that child is that they are so courageous.
Hmm.
When the amygdala calms down and now the frontal lobes and other parts of the brain can start having its day in the sun. That child is not just feisty anymore. They are protectors of the weak. I can't tell you how many kids like this become beautiful with animals, for example.
Yeah.
Or just gorgeous with friends or little kids and will help them.
Yeah.
And they're in there, but they are incredibly helpful and they're courageous and they're little social activists and they grow up to be really movers and shakers.
Mm-hmm.
But the decision was made by their parents to actually not overwhelm them.
Yeah.
That kind of gets me to the second point that one of your viewers just wrote in, and thank you for that point about soccer and ballet and all that stuff that comes up. There's a really interesting piece of data, bear with me because it sounds a bit weird, but it's from the Trade Department.
Okay.
That by 2035, over 85% of all employment will be self-employed, project-based, part-time gig-based.
Wow. Okay. Right? Yeah.
Right, so that's the world our kids are going into. That's a vast majority of jobs.
Yeah.
Now, Dawn, you've probably been self-employed freelance in your life, and a lot of people listening in here have been too, or know someone like that.
Mm-hmm.
Dawn, if I could take the liberty of asking you, to be self-employed, to be freelance, what are some words that occur to you to be successful at that?
Probably self-directed and maybe driven, although I'm worried that's the wrong word for
self-directed.
Right.
but you know, really, but you go for it. There's grit, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would add to that problem solving and a lot of people skills.
Yes. Okay.
You have to really be very socially sensitive to others.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it's innovative. Now, if we put all that together, where kids learn to do that is through play,
mm-hmm.
through free, unstructured play. They learn it through boredom.
Yes.
In the book, I write about the gift of boredom.
Yes.
They learn it from being bored. There's nothing to do. There's nothing to do, you know.
Yes.
And my kids would say that. It's, oh, something to do will be just around the corner. You know, and then you overcome the boredom. You overcome the barrier within you, boredom or whatever it is. You overcome it and you find something to do that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
You find something to do to pour your creativity into.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why do we think kids are going to learn that if they're in piano lessons on Monday, soccer on Tuesday, ballet on Thursday, you know, psychotherapy on Friday to cope with it all, wild play therapy.
But Kim, but that's what we think though, right? Because we think, well, they're learning creativity and, you know, music promotes empathy, I think I've heard, and soccer, that's teamwork. And so we've been led to believe that it's these activities that are helping to foster that. Even when you said, like, you have a young social activist on your hands, I'm thinking, oh, well, what opportunities do we need to get them in front of and how can we help them hone this skill, right? And what you're saying is it's the exact opposite. Like,
it's all that stuff that we were talking about has some value. It has some. It's not valueless. I've got to say that to be correct, politically correct. I don't believe it, but I'll just say it. But it's extrinsic. It's outside the child. It's being created for them. Like Steve Jobs, for example, didn't have screens for his kids. And when he was asked why there weren't screens for his kids, he said words to the effect of, why would I want them to watch someone else's creativity? Right? This is Steve Jobs. So the all that other stuff, no, it does have some minor value. You compare a soccer game, like, oh, we've got to get them into soccer to socialize them. Compare that to that same 9-year-old child building a fort with four other kids.
Yeah.
Compare the social and emotional skills that building a fort has. Mm-hmm. Like, no, let's build it this way. No, that'll fall. Oh, yeah, okay, well, let's do it. All right, we can do it that way, but let's put the roof on my way. All right, you can put the roof, but we can build this, and you just, it's continual. Yes. And then they get down to building it. It's like, hand me this. Okay, and you've got, now compare that, honestly. Yeah. To the amount of social skill and negotiation, genuine face-to-face, working it all out, it's minimal compared to giving children spaces so that they can have an internal loci.
Yeah.
Their center of gravity, social gravity, is inside themselves, mm-hmm. not external.
Yeah.
Right?
So for those parents who really like formulas, how many hours of unstructured play, or what percentage of their day, or however you want to quantify it, how much unstructured playtime should they have if we prioritize that first, and then to know if we even have the space to add on like outside activities or other things?
The interesting thing, and this is just an example, but it's I co-authored another book called Beyond Winning, A Smart Parenting in a Toxic Youth Sports Environment. Mm. And I wrote it because I experienced it from the inside out. I was a so-called youth elite athlete, represented my country, all that sort of stuff. So I know it from the inside.
Yeah.
Right? And I know the good, the bad, and the ugly about it. For example, one of the pieces of research that myself and Scott and Luis, my co-authors, found was that if you start a child in competitive sports before the age of 12, by the age of 16, 73% will have quit. Now, having raised a 18-year-old, when they are 16, 17, 18 years old, you want them to be passionate about sports because there's a lot of other stuff out there. You do not want them.
Okay.
To
yes.
be passionate about, mm-hmm. right? This book, Simplicity Parenting, originally was going to be called Slow Start, Strong Finish, like a marathon metaphor. But editors didn't like that. But it's kind of true. If you start kids, it's not that we don't want our kids to be social activists, mm-hmm. right? But if we want them to be social activists, they start with playing in the park at a pickup game or building a fort. Or playing at home or making an obstacle course for their bikes and all that sort of stuff, because there's creativity, deep creativity. But again, coming back to formulas, it's hard to say, but if you've got your kid in any more than one or two after school activities, because school is already a lot to cope with, then it's probably too many. If you think about in terms of the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system, most of us know a little bit about that these days or know those terms, but school is much of it is sympathetic nervous system. It's all intake. It's all absorbing, stimulating, taking in, responding, reacting, even recess, or especially recess. Mm-hmm. But the classes, the transitions, our home life is one of the few places where we can have the parasympathetic nervous system. That's the soothing, calming, and crucially, it's digesting. Hmm. So the children can sleep at night. So when they're laying in bed, their wheels still aren't spinning.
Interesting.
So they're not trying to over-control things because it's all that they're trying to digest everything.
Hmm.
I think of it a little bit the metaphor, Dawn, is like a cup. You know, if you think of a cup with a tap pouring into it, water pouring into this cup, and for the tap and the water, the faucet and the water coming in, it's like that's life. That's the sympathetic nervous system. That's a lot going on there. You know, it's pouring into a child's vessel, into them, You know, all the things they're coping with at school, all the friendships, then the homework, and then coming home, and then then soccer, and then they're coping with a lot. Mm-hmm. And that's pouring into the cup.
Okay.
Now, for many kids, that cup is spilling. It's just, it's all good stuff. I'm not saying these things aren't, you know, don't have goodness somewhere in them. Mm-hmm. But it's too much good stuff. It's just too much. Yeah. And the water is spilling out the side. Now, that spillage is behavior. Mm-hmm. That spillage is when kids start acting out or getting stubborn or refusing. Mm-hmm. We've got a choice to make as parents. Do we want to spend our life mopping up spillage, dealing with behavior, or do we just want to turn the tap down?
Yeah.
Just turn the tap down and you will get a much calmer kid that when they get excited, which is great, they can become calm and center themselves quickly. It's not like you want them to be zen and calm all the time. You want them to be wildly enthusiastic, but then they can come back and be calm and then enthusiastic and then calm.
That's so good. And I know I love all of the different examples and illustrations that you give in your book. And so you talk a lot how, you know, highly simplifying our environments. And we will talk about kind of some steps to that. But lots of examples how it helps with ADD, ADHD, OCD, ODD. And I am seeing a comment from a mom right now too, wondering, in your work, do you see differences with children with autism as well?
Kids who are neurodiverse are amazing kids. I've worked with so many of them over the years, been with them, accompanied them. I was a school counselor for, you know, 25 years. And they are just highly aware of what's going on around them. It's not universal, but, and it's not all the time. But with children who are neurodiverse, and I would include into that hyperactive, like clinically hyperactive, they have like, unless we're careful, their sympathetic nervous system, the intake, has like a sticky on switch.
Okay.
And they're taking in and they're very, very open. I think of them as little sunflowers. They just open, you know, and they just follow the sun. They're beautiful kids, but they take everything in. Now, we think of children who are neurodiverse, autistic children, as closed down, but they've closed down, not entirely, but largely they've closed down because there's too much out there to take in. It's protective. Mm-hmm. What countless parents have said, and now former director of all our trainings, because we train simplicity parenting coaches, right, and group leaders. We've trained like 1,200 coaches over the years. Uh-huh. And it's a simple little training because, well, it'd be ironic if it was complicated, right? But she is raising a neurodiverse autistic boy. And the reason she was drawn into this work was when she started balancing and simplifying and dialing back, that need for self-protection started falling away. And I've seen this in so many children, that when you calibrate life out there, then in here, the child feels safe to just peep out a little bit more and then peep out a little bit more and then not loop and obsess about things, because that's also, that can also ease up. It doesn't go away. I'm not claiming miracles, but it's malleable. It's much, much, much more malleable. Okay. Because then the amount of intake, basically kids who are neurodiverse need us to pay impeccable attention to the parasympathetic nervous system in their lives, downtime, calm time, and particularly, and this is something I talk about in the book, Dawn, is this rhythm and predictability, so they know what's coming next without it becoming rigid. You know, I don't mean that, but they can just basically relax into their lives. Mm-hmm. And don't need to sort of do a lot of that compensatory behavior. We can try to teach. See, this is the other way to go about it, right? We can have a neurodiverse kid and we can put them in classes so that we absolutely teach them how to be normal, how to mask themselves, how to be normal. The other way to do that, and I'm not suggesting these two things, I'm not suggesting kids shouldn't be taught how to cope with certain environments, of course. Mm-hmm. But there's way, in my opinion, there's way too much emphasis on that kind of thing of teaching them to be normal. They are who they are, and they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. The thing that we can do, which is just straight up kind, is to dial their lives back, to make it predictable, to make it rhythmical. And then the amount of masking, the amount of turning away from all that stimulation, we don't need to then be so hard with teaching them how to behave in an environment, because the environment is not overwhelming in the first place. It's a lot easier for them to be in that environment.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's another long answer. Whoops.
No, I think this is wonderful because this is brand new information for a lot of parents. And so I think, so you're talking to an audience that values simple living. In this group, we're working on decluttering our homes. And so I would like you to walk through a few practical things that we could be intentional about with our kids and simplifying our environment, because I know it's not just physical stuff. And then I also want to ask you, because I know many moms are saying, well, especially my ADHD and autistic children are really attached to their stuff. So I know that question is probably floating through a lot of the minds right now. So do know we will get to that. But first, will you just help give us some basics of when you're talking about simplifying our children's environment, what are kind of the key aspects of that?
Yeah, the autistic kids, those two things are really interwoven. And I really appreciate you pointing that out. For autistic kids, I prefer the term neurodiverse, but whatever, you know, for neurodiverse autistic kids who also loop in their behavior, they might not be autistic, but they loop. You actually don't simplify the environment first. You don't take away their toys and their books. What you do is you actually move to other areas and make their lives much more rhythmical and predictable.
Okay.
You dial back scheduling. Okay. Crucially, you dial back screens, because that is nervous system overwhelm. We can come to that later. And after that's in place, then their systems have calmed enough to not feel so desperately attached to their things.
Okay.
Because they're desperately attached to their things because that's their survival. That's how they get through.
Okay.
If we take away the need to survive, that's the amygdala again and the basal ganglia. If we take away that need first, then we can simplify the environment, right? Okay. Just
that's
to answer
great.
That
yeah.
question. Mm-hmm. Okay, now then back to the first part of the question. One of the things that our coaches from all around the world, because we have coaches just about everywhere in the world, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if one turned up in Antarctica at some stage. They're all over the place. So it's very cross-cultural, the feedback we get. One of the things I've learned since writing the book, emphasized over and over by our coaches, is if you're going to simplify books and toys and clothes and stuff, then it's best to start with our own spaces first.
Mm.
So we start with our spaces, our bedrooms, our studies, our spaces. And it's not just decluttering, it's organizing. And then after we organize our spaces and declutter, then common spaces, the kitchen, lounge room, organize, declutter. And then a lot of kids will say, well, why can't I have my bedroom be so nice?
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, and then that comes as a third step. Well, yes, we can, sweetheart. We'll as opposed to a raiding party on a child's bedroom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing that with this though, Dawn, is that, the reason for decluttering and organizing is I don't think it's ever been more needed, because out there in the world, if you think about out there in here, right, out there in here, out there, it's really disorganized at the moment. We're in this post-COVID out there, and things are still kind of bent all out of shape. Mm-hmm. And our kids are coming out of a time where out there it was very choppy.
Mm-hmm.
So in here, what we can do is make it visually, lots of visual clarity, lots of vertical, horizontal clarity. On the horizontal plane, you want to be able to see the shelves. You want want to be able to see the lintels. You want to be able to see and not have too much between you and the horizontal. So those bookshelves, all the toys, the projects, all the project making equipment needs to be in baskets so that the children can actually see the horizontal and the vertical. That is spatially. A lot of studies into that spatially. It's very restful.
Yes.
A lot of the minimalist spaces, though, we've got to be a little bit careful of, because a lot of them are a lot of glass and wood. And I know it looks but there's a lot of noise that bounces all over the place. So I'm a big fan of area rugs.
And throw pillows? I get made fun of her. Throw pillows.
Yes, hello. Nicely organized, nicely done, and not overdone, but not noise that's bouncing all over the place. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of harsh cleaning fluid smells. Most of us are onto that these days. Mm-hmm. You know, we have these plug-in things from Johnson & Johnson, who are a family company, but they're not our family. You know, it's not. The olfaction is a very primitive sensory safety.
Oh, interesting.
So when children come into a home, they don't want to smell masking smells, because that means there could be a monster.
Wow.
All right. So they want to smell home. You know, when Dawn, you know, when you go back to grandma's, if you and you smell her home, and if grandma was kind and a good and a safe person, you just like, it's the smell.
It's comforting, yeah.
It's comforting right there. Yeah. So when a child comes home, we have to be careful about having either neutral or very low odor cleaning materials.
Yeah.
Of course we have to clean. Mm-hmm. We have to be very careful about scents and perfumes and aftershaves and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, a little bit, of course, I won't be silly about it, but just for a child, when they snuggle, for a baby to snuggle, they want to smell you, not Giorgio number 5.
Yeah.
7. I don't know which Giorgio. but they it's deeply, deeply satisfying for children, that sense of olfaction. So all these things are what makes home a basically a little bit of an oasis. Mm-hmm. Out there, it's very disorganized. So I want to emphasize this. It's not just having this sort of Danish Zen scene going on at home. You can still have good stuff around, but it needs to be a nice basket. I'm a fan of baskets, not those plastic tubs.
Okay.
But you know, if you've got to have a plastic tub, have it. But what, and it's, and with older kids, they like to even label them, or, you know, so that when a child says, where's the big knife, or where's the big scissors? And you can say, oh, sweetheart, I think it's over in the scissors basket.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Now the child goes over to the scissors basket, looks in, and there are the big scissors. That means to a child, all is well with the world.
Yeah.
Wow. We're not just doing it to have a magazine ready photo shoot home.
Yeah.
We're doing it because it actually settles the child down so that they can move into being creative and is not on that kind of slightly high alert.
Yeah. Well, and Kim, I'm even thinking this. I mean, my husband has made the comment, when the kitchen's clean, I feel like life is under control. And so I'm even wondering, I'm sure you see this with adults with anxiety and different things in our own worlds going on. I mean, similar response. Is that true?
That's a really smart husband. He's a keeper. No, but that's someone really in touch with their instincts, actually. Yeah, I remember meeting a teacher once who was working, a special educator, had a very inner city area, had a very stressful job. And when it was particularly stressful, I saw her going out one day, and she had all this cowboy gear on. And I said to Susie, where are you going? And she said, after days like this, I need to go square dancing.
Mm.
And I just smiled and said, oh, I hope you have a lovely time. And she said, do you want to come too? And I said, I'll save it up for a stressful day. But what she did was, she was seeking form. She was seeking form. And this is a really natural instinct, especially for children. And that brings us, I guess, neatly to that second point of rhythm, right? Mm-hmm. Can we look at that a little bit, like rhythm, predictability? Mm-hmm. Because when we have rhythm for children, when they know what's coming next, I think of this as the macro and micro rhythms. Anyone who wants to follow up on this can check out the podcast, the Simplicity Parenting podcast. So I'll just nutshell it now. Okay. I won't go into it too much. But the macro rhythms are the big when, like when we get up, when we have our breakfast, when we have our morning tea, our snack, the big wins, all the when we have bath time, when bed. And then the micro rhythms are the little hows, how we get up. There's our scarecrow of clothes that we laid out the night before. It's very settling. I learned to do that with my daughter because at the age of 2, I realized she was a fashionista. I knew, right? And so the decisions around whether she wanted the sparkly socks or the rainbow socks could take a long time in the morning. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we had to get somewhere, right? So so there's my scarecrow, and I put my clothes on, or I get up, and in the mornings, my daddy comes in singing that same morning song. Mm-hmm. And then he lights the morning candle, and then he rubs my back with that nice smelling cream. I like that cream. He gives my back a rub. This all took, you know, this, I'm not making this up. This is the way I woke up. And 1.5 minutes. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, it's not going to the spa. It's just really simple. Yeah. Then we would snuggle just for a little bit, and then we go to the bathroom for pee-pee. But while I'm on the bathroom, and there's all these little when, mm-hmm. how, all the way down. And here's where I sit. Here's my Winnie the Pooh bowl. Here's my, this is when they were very little. It's like the connective tissue, because if you have big whens without the little hows, it becomes rigid.
Wow.
But that's the worry I think we all have about rhythm, is we don't want to have routine. I think there's a difference between routine is cold, separating,
okay.
Disconnecting, whereas rhythm is warm, predictable, and very, very, very connecting. And when we have that in a child's life, all the little breadcrumbs, like basically all the little things we do, and every time a child sits down to eat, young ones, you know, if they're home or on the vacation as we have coming up now, even older ones, we just preview the next couple of hours before we eat. It's really simple to do, actually.
Yeah.
You just sit there and you say you're about to clean up, the kids have eaten, and you say, now, okay, so from snack up until lunch, it's outdoors time, right? You guys were gonna go outside? Okay, what you gonna do? All right, you're gonna do the bike ramp, the jump? Okay, good. Don't forget to put your helmet on, you know, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then you preview the next 2 hours, then lunch happens, they've eaten. They're good. Yeah. What's happening up until afternoon tea, until snack? And so you preview. And that's all the connective tissue. Now, if you do that, and especially the feedback we've had is that when you have rhythm, the big rhythms, the little rhythms in place, not everything has to then be so hard because you're not making it up.
Yeah.
Because they know what's coming next within reason. You know, like it's got to have, that's the great thing about rhythm, is that when you've got really good rhythms and you get knocked out of rhythm and you've got to do, like you have extended family visiting or something like that, or there's, you know, there's big events that happen, stuff you've got to do, then you've got something to return to.
Yeah.
Then the kids reset really quickly. And
yeah.
So rhythm is, because again, out there in here, out there, it's really choppy at the moment. Is there school? Is there not school? Our kids have come through. There's school. There's masking. No school's out. Then and they've come from this sort of choppiness, mm-hmm. of dramatic unpredictability, more than I think pretty much we've experienced in many, many, many decades, perhaps since the Second World War and in war zones.
Mm-hmm.
We've just been through a war zone, and I know war zones. I've been in them.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing more and more and more kids really struggling with retained primitive reflexes, with sensory integration issues, because they just simply haven't felt safe. One of the ways we can keep kids safe is to declutter and organize, point one. Point two is have little and big rhythms.
Yeah,
there's two other points I talk about in the book, but mm-hmm. they're big ones. They're, I'd say of all the things that have been going on lately, having rhythm and predictability is perhaps one of the beginning points. And wow. And one doesn't need to become rigid about it.
Yeah. I'm seeing comments about two things. You can pick which order you answer them in. One, how do I get my kids off of screens? How do we work backwards from that? And if my kids are older, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, is it too late? Erin, are there still any things that I can do with them?
I think actually simplifying kids' lives when they're 16, 17, 18 is even more important. Only the way we do it, because they tend to overcommit. Right. I've got a teenager at home, you know, they tend to say yes to everything outside the house, no to a lot inside. And I don't say this to be self-referential, Dawn, but in my book, The Soul of Discipline, I talk about three different phases, and I'll just really nutshell this because it's way too much to go into now, but I talk about when children are little, they need us to be the governor of the family state. The metaphor I use is the governor. Mm-hmm. You know, we're establishing, it's a time of establishing values. Here's what we don't do, but here's how we do it. Here's what we do when we come to the dinner table. Here's what we don't do. We don't jump down. We don't throw food around. No, but here's what we do. And it's like, here's what we don't do and here's what we do. Right up until about the age of 7 or 8 is a real, and I think we're the governor, and it's the kindly governor, not the sort of malevolent dictator.
But
it's firm and it's kind, but it is firm. And then once kids hit about sort of 8 or 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 even, the metaphor I use is the gardener. So it moves from the governor to the gardener.
Okay.
And the gardener plants, allowing space for those plants to grow into. So a good gardener is listening to the children a lot, but then we'll make a decision. I remember my own 9-year-old one day, it was a Friday night, and I said, sweetheart, before tomorrow morning, would you like to tell me what it is you'd like to do tomorrow? It's Saturday. And she said, well, daddy. Well, as a matter of fact, yes. I'm rather glad you asked. That's how she talks, by the way. I'm rather glad you asked. I'd like to. And she said 3 or 4 things. And we worked out, we couldn't do all those, but some of those. And maybe next Saturday we could do that. And we figured it out. And then as we were ending, she said, Daddy, I rather like it when you talk to me like that. We'll do that some more, won't we?
Wow.
And you know, it was a very sweet moment. And I obviously remember it to this day. But that's, see, a 9, 10-year-old don't want to be treated like a 4-year-old, but they're not a teenager.
Yeah.
So she could tell me what her wishes are. I don't know if you caught that, Dawn, but she could tell me what she wanted.
Yeah.
I could give her the space to have her voice be heard. But ultimately, it was I decided what we could and we couldn't do.
Yeah.
And then now we're getting to the next stage, the final stage. Once a kid hits 14, 15, 16, I think of that as the guide. So we move from governor to gardener to guide. Some of the best conversations I've ever had with teenagers have been about their direction and how we can get there. And whether what they're doing and their behavior is a distraction or a direction.
Mm.
Because they can be spectacularly disinterested in our opinions at that age, but they're very interested in their emerging direction.
Mm.
This is a direct answer, sorry, but those three phases are very important to actually understand, very important to understand. Because if we don't change, if we don't shift as they're moving through those three phases, we lose them. If we've got a 16-year-old and we're trying to be the governor all the time, they're going to reject us.
Yeah.
But if we've got a very little kid, like a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, and we're trying to guide them, asking them a lot of questions. What would you like to do? How would that be? Okay. And that's much more the modern tendency, is to parent very little children like they're actually 5, but we're parenting them like they're 18.
Yeah.
Way too many choices. Way too many open-ended choices. It makes them feel, when they don't know who's in charge and who's keeping them safe, they get very, very nervous and anxious. And a lot of the parents I work with, because I still have a parent counseling practice. So I meet with parents like this afternoon, I'll be meeting with a bunch of parents. And one of the things they tell me about is that when they finally kind of shape up and become the governor, right? Mm. Kind, but very clear, their children relax. Wow. Because when you have boundaries in place, and this is the thing we tend to forget, when we've got a boundary in place for a little child, that not only means I'm meeting that boundary, it also means there's a fence there that keeps the scary things out. We forget boundaries keep scary stuff out as much as they hold kids in with acceptable limits of behavior and not just really wild stuff. When a young person is 16, 17, 18, then we're talking to them about living a balanced life, even if life's been a bit wacko, because living a balanced life enables them to be in their frontal lobes of their brain, the executive brain. They're not in their animal brain, their reptilian brain. They're in their frontal lobes. And if they want to do well with their SATs, if they want to do well, if they want to have good friends and not always be on edge, if they want to do well in life, get a part-time job that's successful when they're 17, then there's the living a balanced life. It's like, we know we need balance in food. You know, we know we can eat a certain amount of sugar and all that sort of stuff, but we also need good, nutritious food. We need a balance in sleep. We need certain amounts of sleep. But we also need certain amounts of balance in stimulation. Because without that balance in stimulation, then our brain is on overdrive, and our capacity to learn and to be able to absorb information at school and not have to work so hard, not have to just be able to basically remember stuff, but also be a good friend, also be relaxed enough to have a good friend and be fun and not be anxious. That depends on living a balanced life. And I've had that conversation with countless teenagers. If you want to do what you want to do, not what I want you to do, but if you want to do what you want to do, then we've got to talk about how we can get this balanced for you so you can go in the direction that is your direction. There was another one though, right?
Yeah, for the parents that need to dial back screen time with their kids. And I know I'm also seeing like some parents feel like, I've already ruined my child. Like, they live on a screen. So is the damage irreversible, and how do we begin to dial that back with our kids? I say that jokingly too.
The damage is absolutely not permanent with screens, but the damage is absolutely real. Mm-hmm. The jury is in now. The research is absolutely compelling that screens are not good for kids' neural development. In the Simplicity Parenting book, that second edition that you've got a hold of, when the editors asked me to, like when I first wrote Simplicity Parent, the first edition, I was still talking about Blackberries. Do you know what I mean? And things have moved some. So that chapter in that book took a full year to research, because there's so much research out there, and you've got to have your ducks in a row when you're starting to edge towards the national addiction, you know, of screens, because it's highly, highly addictive, and it's meant to be. It's not an accident. I don't want to go into this too much now, because we kind of all know it. We know this. There's been too many whistleblowers. It's gotten way out of the realm of conspiracy theory. We know this is not good for our kids. Is that it? Is no. The brain is very, very plastic. It can start to myelinate again. I would recommend, highly, highly recommend Victoria Dunkley's book, The 28-Day Brain Reset. Victoria Dunkley is a medical doctor. It's Dunckley. If you have any millennials watching now, they'll already be typing that in. It's amazing we can do this. It's a brain reset. And Victoria Dunkley has a beautiful, amazing website. And many of the people I work with, the parents I work with over the years, have done a brain reset, and it was of my own invention. Then along comes Victoria, who's a leading medical doctor, very respected medical doctor in this realm, and her way of approaching this is better than mine. It's just it's a really, really good way of doing it. So I fold that in, to with her permission, of course, to much of what I'm doing, because this is a question on many people's minds.
Yes.
Now, if you do a brain reset, you will be everything from pleased to amazed at how your children's behavior changes, how their ability to be creative, their ability to get on with each other. It's not they won't still get up to mischief, they're kids, but the malleability, how easy it is to bring them back into the flow of the day. They will be different children. One of the things I emphasize is a ramping on and a ramping off. And Victoria talks about this too. But as you ramp onto it, this is where often her and my work have been put together. Because if you can make life really rhythmical and make it more predictable, have less schedules, be less busy. Now, this may sound counterintuitive, but be less busy, then the children will not need the dopamine hits of screens nearly so much. Dopamine is that quick reward, pleasure, reward, very quick, very quick. That's very, very, very hard for children who have been tuned to dopamine to then, if you say to them, and remember, pleasure, reward, and you say, Sophie, it's time to clean up your room.
There's not much reward in that, huh? Compared to the screens.
Right. And it's and so it's not their fault. That, but what you'll notice if you do this 28-day brain reset is how the ordinary things in the flow of the day just become easy, much easier. That feedback is absolutely universal.
Okay.
Of all the parents who have been through a screen detox, it's only a relatively small number that have ever gone back to using screens or back in the same way.
Yeah.
Or if they have gone back to screens, they really curate. They are very, very careful.
Okay.
What the kids watch and how long they watch it. The difficulty is what I call screen creep, where it just creeps more and more and more. And again, that's not the kids' fault. For years, I've tried to get into a very exclusive children's marketing conference.
Okay.
And I haven't got in because they must check people out, and they all they have to do is check me out. And I'm talking to folk like you, Dawn, being like, but also like NBC, like these like things they can easily find. And there I am being rude about them, right? Anyway, recently I got into the conference because it went virtual.
Okay.
And the reason I'm mentioning this is that all the big breakfast cereal makers, particularly the app designers, hardware, software, a clothing company, all the folk that market to children and tweens and teens, they were all there. Even the auto companies, the car making companies, because they know that if you can get a child's brand recognition by the age of two, you'll have brand loyalty by the age of six, right?
Wow.
So if you look at those car ads, a lot of them have got kids in them. Right? That's not random. Anyway, I went to this conference and I followed where everyone was going. And it was a large group of people. And the conference was worth the rather expensive price to get into it for two words. We are no longer regularly referred to, Dawn, you and me, as parents. We have a new name. Our new name is purchasing friction.
Oh, man.
That's our name. And the conference, the biggest workshop where there were hundreds of people, because it was the third in a series, was case studies, reports and case studies from the successful removal of purchasing friction. And they spend $16 billion a year in this country removing our values from our kids' lives.
Yeah.
Now, it's just, as a parent, it's just too hard to compete against such psychologically manipulative and really clever people. They're really smart. I'm just not that smart as a daddy to compete. And I have studied psychology all my life. But
well, we don't even know we are competing, right? Like, not even are we not smart enough. We're not even aware that we're competing.
Right. Because there's product placements, there's influencers, there's just, they went through the list. And what they'll do is they'll first of all try to flatter us as parents. Like, if you buy this, you are going to be so loved.
Yes. You're a better parent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then if that doesn't work, because a lot of us are kind of onto that, or we can't afford it. If that doesn't work, then they say to the kids, your parents are really dumb. They don't know. They are self-interested, and they portray adults as just disconnected, and you're the ones that know. And then they know this study into pester power, pester as in pestering someone. Mm-hmm. And if a child receives a screen-driven message, I write about this in the book, they'll come back over 20 times, 24 times, over and over and over to get those pair of sneakers, to get that T-shirt, to get that game, to get that app, like over and over. Without a screen-driven request, if it's a friend at school who has a new pair of sneakers and they want it just like that, they'll come back 3 times.
Wow.
Normal is 3.
Wow.
And they know this. The pester power study it's been around for a while now, and they know it and they play on it. So we're really being messed with, mm-hmm. and our families, and it's our family values that are being messed with.
Yeah.
And this is not conspiracy theory. It's kind of the opposite. They're very open about
it. They're very obvious about it. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I know we need to wind up. There's one question I've been seeing repeated, though, is because we do have many grandparents watching as well, which we're so grateful for. If this is resonating with them, they want to present these ideas to their children so it can influence their grandchildren. Do you have any tips for how grandparents can help with this?
Grandparenting is such a beautiful and delicate art. Right.
That's a good way to put it.
Because there's the governor, the gardener, the guide. That's how we're parenting. But then what happens when now our own kids grow up and have their children? Mm. And we're, in a sense, we're witnessing. We're active, we're witnessing at this point. One of the things about simplicity parenting is that if you're talking to your granddaughter, talking to your daughter or your grown-up daughter or son, child, grown-up child, you can start at the simplest thing. Like, let's say it's just starting with organizing their craft table. Hmm. And just buying some nice little baskets that you've measured up that will fit right on. And there's very few parents, you know, your own children, who say, please don't organize the crafting table.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
You can start with whatever you think. In our coaches often talk about small and doable. Start small and doable.
Yeah.
Whatever you think will be small and doable. And just go about it gently and slowly. Know mm-hmm. that there's years and years that you've got mm-hmm. with you know, that your granddaughter. And also, when they come to your place, turn off the screens. Mm-hmm. Grandparents, now I get this feedback, not from the grandparents who are listening in today, right?
Yeah.
It really isn't, because, you know, it's self-selective. But grandparents are for many parents, I'm flipping the script a little bit. Mm-hmm. Grandparents are the main culprits of overwhelming children with sugar mm-hmm. and screens.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I'm so delighted to have the question from the grandparent who just posed that is that they're aware of it.
Yeah.
These are very, very lucky, lucky grandchildren.
Yeah.
So when they come to you, have a simple, connected environment. Have things to do, not too many, just little things to do. A little cycling, you know, trip, a crafting table that's beautifully organized, some baking to do.
Yeah.
It was Stephen Covey back in the early 2000s who wrote the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Grandparents. No, they didn't call it that, but he could have, because what he wrote about was knowing what your circle of control is.
Oh, right. Yes.
And knowing what your circle of concern is.
Yeah.
Now, if your circle of concern is your kids are living an out of whack life, mm-hmm. like really just crazy busy, always go, 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 go. You can't change that. That's your circle of concern. But a highly effective grandparent will say, well, what's within my control? Well, when they come over, we can turn the screens off, even put them away, literally just gone.
Yeah.
We can be careful not to have scary conversations around the kids about politics and about war.
Yeah.
We can get some crafting projects ready. It's not always, I'm going to go here, we're going to do that, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. It's just yes, maybe once a day go do something. But the other times, and we can, so this is our circle of control.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you do that enough, I think there's a third circle, which is the circle of control is small. It's the size of a grapefruit. Our circle of concern for our grandchildren is the size of a beach ball. It's big.
Mm-hmm.
But within our circle of control, if we do that enough and the kids like it, and they will like it, what child doesn't like baking and hearing stories of grandma when she was a naughty little girl? The naughty is the best stories, right? But they do. They love it. And that then increases our circle of influence and also authenticity. So if you talk to your own son or daughter, your own grown-up child, about more downtime, and when they come over to visit you, you're having more downtime, then you're being real.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just philosophical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's so good. Well, I'm seeing many comments of don't let this end. This is so good and so helpful, but we will wrap up for today. Of course, we're going to link to your books down below as well as your podcast. And so Kim, thank you so much for being with us and sharing all this valuable information. I know we're all so grateful.
Oh, it's so nice to meet you, Dawn. Keep it up. Yay.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you're looking for more support, be sure to check out The Minimal Mom on YouTube too. And we'll see you next time.